I have known, Angel and I have known Miriam and her husband Justin since we were in college. I met Justin when he lived two doors down from me my freshman year, and eventually he started dating Miriam. I remember some of the people she dated before her husband, so I got the dirt on her. But we've known them since we went to school together. We went to seminary together. And she graduated from Duke Divinity School in 2006 and has been serving as a pastor back here in Illinois ever since then. Her husband, Justin, is also a pastor. He serves at St. James Danville, which, you know, just down the road, down the interstate. They have two wonderful children, Sam, who is downstairs at Kids Quest because he was here in worship at first service, and Katie, who is sick this morning. She woke up sick this morning, so they had to call grandparents in very early. So make sure that you say a prayer for Katie and for parents and grandparents this morning. I've tried to think about what else to tell you about Miriam when you've known somebody so long. What do you tell people? I did remember as we were singing, Miriam grew up, I think, in kind of a charismatic Pentecostal tradition. All right, so if you have amens and stuff you want to holler out while she's preaching, she'll be okay with it. You won't freak her out, all right? All right, so I'm going to welcome her up here to preach. I'm going to ask you to welcome her, and I'm going to go down and spend some time with the kids today while she's preaching. I already heard this and took great notes right here. So, all right, Miriam, come on up, and let's welcome her.
Good morning. I am so thrilled to be back with you. The last time I preached for Quest Church was about 5.5, going on 6 years ago, and you were still worshiping at Next Generation School and having to like set everything up and then do it and take everything down. And I'm glad now to be here in one of your many locations, and hopefully this is one that you'll be able to hang out in and make yours over the course of time and make fit you. But I'm thrilled to be back. As Casey said, we've known each other for a really long time. I think it's kind of funny that one of my first real serious dates with my husband, we had only really been dating for a couple of months, but we were getting a little bit more serious, and he took me as his date to Casey and Angel's wedding. Yeah, it's a solid date. You know, somebody else pays for the food and the entertainment. And when you're in college, you know, that is just handy sometimes. But it wasn't really until after I had been a guest at their wedding that I got to know Casey and Angel. And I was just thrilled again then when we were able to go to seminary together. And I got to be one of the very first people to hold their first child, Josiah, in the hospital after they strategically had him on the very first day of spring break, you know, so you can just, you know, head back to school like a week later. But it has just been a thrill to be their friend. And now it's just one of the most wonderful things. I don't know if you've had friendships long enough and you've gotten married and you have children and then your children get to be friends with your friends' children. It is just so beautiful. It's beautiful to listen to Sam and to Shepherd talk to each other. Angel comments and I've commented when we've taken them someplace together and they'll be talking in the back seat and then all of a sudden I'll hear Shepherd say, "Well, you know, Sam, it says in the Bible." And I'm like, wow, you can tell they're pastor's kids. They're like budding evangelists. It is just a wonderful, wonderful thing. So I'm thrilled to be back here and to be with you this morning. And I'm privileged and pleased. I am the associate or discipleship pastor at Wesley. Wesley's the Methodist church that's on campus. And I get to hang out with just wonderful people there. And I just keep trying to fly under the radar screen so that I can hang out there for as long as I possibly can. It's just great fun to be around young adults who are learning and growing in wonderful ways. And college students, one of my great privileges, I'm technically the associate for the church. And then there's an associate that's the campus minister. The campus minister is wonderful, and she lets me hang out with college students. So every Friday, I get to sit and do Bible study with a group of undergraduate students. And I always want to study what they want to do and what they want to learn. And they are just willing to study and dive into anything. And this past semester, I asked what they really wanted to study, and they told me Job. So if you really want to Startle your pastor sometime. Just request a study on the book of Job. It's not the easiest passage to move through. And this semester, we've been studying the parables. And I don't know if you've read parables recently, but they are some tough, there are some tough, tough things that Jesus says in the parables. And I just love to hear the reflections of my students and to see how they're growing in faith. And I was really, really pleased just this past week, one of my students was accepted to go to Duke Divinity School, where Casey and Angel and I all graduated. So I'm thrilled to now send others on into ministry. And it's just such a great privilege. So if you'll pray with me, I will pray for you this morning. We will jump into Psalm 37. Oh God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, for you are our rock and you are our redeemer. Amen. How many of you remember writing acrostic poems? Maybe when you were in elementary school or in Sunday school. I really remember them around Mother's Day. And you know, and you write M-O-T-H-E-R down the, you know, left side of a piece of paper, and then you go back to the top, and you brainstorm all of the wonderful words that you could use to describe your mother. M, you know, marvelous or magnificent. O, optimistic. You know, I struggle with O. It's kind of a hard one to find adjectives with, you know, terrific, honest, everything, radiant, you know, we describe our mothers in that way. Actually, if anybody has some construction paper you'd like to loan me, I probably should take an acrostic poem home with wonderful things said about my mother as I called her at 6 o'clock this morning to see if she could come over and watch our five-year-old while Justin, my husband, went to preach at one church and I came over here to be with you. So Grammy is at home with Katie, who's five and has a fever on the couch. So maybe I'll do a little bit of my own poeticness before I head home this morning. But this morning, as we continue in your sermon series on the Psalms as a field guide for prayer, we're turning to Psalm 37. And Psalm 37 is actually an acrostic poem. I know. I was in seminary before I realized that centuries and centuries ago, the Hebrew poets were writing acrostic poems to and about God. They, you know, just, if you know, it helps to think A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way from A, so the Hebrew alphabet, actually, from Aleph to Tav, you know, they would write it on the left-hand side of the paper and then go back up and write their poem or their prayer to God. So I think maybe they wrote some acrostic poems for their mothers as well, but they've written some wonderful acrostic poems for us. I actually know several people in my life who use the alphabet, our English alphabet, as their pattern for prayer. I don't know if you've ever heard of this or if you've ever tried doing this. My husband's grandmother is one of these people. She is one of the most wonderful, sweetest 98-year-old women that I know, and she prays the alphabet every day. So one of the very first things she does, we visited her, and I've seen her in her bedroom as she is scribbling and praying through her alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And then I know that when she gets to the letter M, she's praying for me. And when she gets to the letter K, she's praying for my daughter, and S, she's praying for my son, and J, she's praying for my husband. And she does this every day. And I can say that it is quite a humbling experience to know that somebody is praying so intentionally for you every day. It's just one of those glorious, glorious things. And I'm not sure if great-grandma LaWanda realizes the origins of her pattern of prayer, but she definitely demonstrates for us how the Psalms are truly a field guide for our lives of prayer together. So besides being an acrostic poem, Psalm 37 is also a wisdom psalm. There aren't very many wisdom psalms in the Psalms. I know Pastor Casey has been guiding you through the different genres of psalms. I know you've looked at praise psalms, and I know that you've done some work with lament psalms. And so today we are going to look at wisdom psalms. And one wisdom psalm in particular, Psalm 37, and search it for what it has to teach us about our lives of prayer. There aren't many psalms that fall into this category, just two or three. There's a larger collection of writings that are referred to as wisdom literature, and you know that as Job and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and teenagers' favorite, Song of Songs. This is what has been passed down to us from the wisdom tradition. But every once in a while, you'll see something that reflects the wisdom tradition in other portions of the Bible, and Psalm 37 is one of those wisdom psalms. So like Proverbs, Psalm 37 it seems very practical, and it seems like a really straightforward moral exhortation for us for wise living. And kind of like the wisdom book of Job, it features a character or a poet who's trying to answer a really big question. Psalm 37, however, is at its very core prayer. And so that's why it finds itself in what Pastor Casey had just said a few moments ago. It finds it in our prayer book, what's been inspiring our prayers and our songs for centuries and centuries. So here's what I would like to do this morning. I would like to just explore with you two things about this wisdom psalm, and then conclude by suggesting how we might put what we've learned into practice. Because really that's what prayer is, it's a practice. And this was driven home to me, this kind of made me think of this week as I was volunteering at my children's school, and I looked into the gymnasium and I saw my kindergarten daughter trying to dribble a basketball. I don't know if you've ever watched a kindergartner try to dribble a basketball, but I'm like, wow, we've got a lot of practice to come to learn all of the different skills that are needed to feel as though we are improving in our lives of prayer. Okay, so the first thing I would like to tell you that is so striking about Psalm 37 is this, and that it is a prayer for the perplexed. It is a prayer for the perplexed. We don't know exactly who the writer is. We don't know exactly the situation that the writer finds himself in, but what we do know is that this is a prayer for the perplexed. He's troubled. He's perplexed. And here's his trouble. Is this. If God prefers wholesome living to disgraceful living, and if God is able to reward and punish, why do evildoers flourish and prosper while the faithful and good often don't? It's related, right, to that other age-old question, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? Except here, it's an age-old question in the form of a prayer. How many of you have ever asked that same question? I mean, how many of us struggle thousands of years later with the same things? How many times have you encountered someone outside of the church who struggle with these big questions, and that's what keeps them at an arm's length distance from God or from the church? Now, I wish I could say this morning that we are going to answer this question. I so wish I could give you an easy answer for this question, but that's not what we find in the psalm. And that doesn't seem to be the main priority of our poet. The poet doesn't offer his readers an answer and doesn't suggest that God has given him the answer to his question. What does seem to matter is that the writer has space and an invitation to ask the question. What seems to matter is that he gets God's attention. What matters is that he pours out his heart to God and affirms that he believes in a God that is good and that created all things and is bringing all things right and will make all things right in the end. This is the only way he knows to work out his troubles, is to have a tough conversation with God himself. A 14th century saint that I really admire, named Saint Teresa of Avila, has this quote where she says, "Prayer is nothing more than being on speaking terms with God." speaking terms with God. Even more, she continues, prayer is being on terms of friendship with God. Our speaking with God brings us into a friendship relationship with God. And so we see, like Job, our writer prefers not simply to talk about God, but to engage in the business of talking directly to God. Not as a skeptic or as a stranger in the faith, but as a friend and a believer. Someone who's wholly committed to God's vision of the world, and he's not afraid to pour out his perplexity in prayer. Now, I don't know about you, but I find it incredibly helpful that our tradition not only gives us examples of giants in the faith asking tough questions of God, but our tradition also affirms that wrestling with tough questions are valid moments in our lives of faith. It's difficult, yes, because there are no easy answers, but conversations with God are always welcome. There's always the space. There's always the invitation. It's how we discover that we fit into a design that's vastly bigger and more complex than we could ever imagine. And yet it's also how we discover that God desires to be in a friendship relationship with us. So big and yet so small and meaningful as well. This leads me to the second striking thing about this psalm, and that's this. The writer's prayer reveals what is really on the line, and that is the well-being and the transformation of his heart. The writer is perplexed, but what his wrestling reveals is an inner struggle. Do not fret, he says, because of the wicked. Do not be envious of wrongdoers. Do not fret over those who prosper in their way, over those who carry out evil devices. Refrain from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil. The poet searches and wrestles and doesn't like what he finds. What he discovers is a jealous and envious heart. While those who do evil prosper, here he is, right? Following all the rules and getting nowhere. And this makes him angry. While those who are guilty of crimes are living a life of wealth and prosperity, people like our poet are grinding their teeth and teetering on the brink of belief. Is there any benefit in being righteous? When do I get what I deserve? Our writer discovers that this is not how he wants to live. When anger and jealousy run amok in our lives out of check and undealt with, they gain power over us, pushing us to take matters into our own hands. Old Testament scholar named Ellen Chari suggests, when she's talking about Psalm 37, suggests that the damage the wicked inflict is psychological. She says they stir up dangerous emotions in the heart of those longing to abide in God. Those who are able to resist being pulled down by such raw negativity, but struggle nonetheless. The psalmist is suggesting we need rescued. We need rescued from becoming lost while walking the Lord's way. She goes on to say this. The psalmist engages here in a high-stakes struggle for the hearts and minds of those who seek to cling to God, yet are understandably torn between keeping faith with God's way and becoming what they hate. Our prayerful poet appeals to us three times in just the first eight verses to not be incensed. Do not become jealous, he says. Do not be envious. Do not fret. Instead, he appeals to us, calling us to patiently wait for the Lord. Take delight in the Lord, he says. Do good. Commit your way to the Lord. Now, what he doesn't do is suggest that we simply ignore bad behavior, but that we wholly commit ourselves to the opposite way of life, a way of life defined by two things: patience and generosity. Patience and generosity. The righteous, he says, are generous and they keep giving. I don't know about you, but when I'm feeling envious or jealous or fretting, the first thing diminished in my life is my generosity toward others. And that's not the person that I want to be, and I don't believe that's the person God is calling me to be. So here's where I would like to conclude. Prayer is a practice, and that is exactly what it takes. It takes practice. And I hope that what you're discovering over these weeks as you are exploring these psalms is that they are not only a field guide for how to pray, but they can also be a field guide for what to pray. I grew up in a church tradition, as Casey said a few minutes ago, that taught that highly energetic, spontaneous prayers were really the only valid kind of prayer. But then I learned several years ago, as I was recovering from having pneumonia, that I really needed the Psalms to pray at all. All I could do, I was so tired, all I could do, I was an intern for the summer at a church, and all I could do was like persevere through several hours of work so that I could go back to where I was living and take a nap for several hours. And I spent several months simply praying the Psalms because I just didn't have any words of my own. I didn't have the energy to come up with the words on my own. But I knew that the well-being of my heart depended upon me having a prayer life and a conversation life with God, even when I wasn't feeling it. What I discovered that summer, however, was how to pray more fully. Because for the first time in my life, I was finally bringing the whole range of my emotions, and I was finally bringing the breadth of my experiences into conversation with God. And as Casey said just a few minutes ago, they are honest prayers. I was giving voice to what perplexed me and what troubled me and what brought me joy and what caused me to lament and so much more. And even if they weren't my original words, they became my words and they became my prayers. One of my very favorite psalms, a psalm that is forever lodged in my memory now since that summer, is Psalm 27. And it starts like this: "The Lord is my light and my salvation. The Lord is my stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid?" And I just pray that over and over and over and over again. And I still find that when I'm feeling lost to myself and need to examine the well-being of my heart, that I return to the Psalms and remember what that summer felt like. If what I feel in my heart is a stir of jealousy or envy, you know, if what we feel in our beings is resisting the hope and the rest of God, then the wisdom of Psalms like Psalm 37 are perfectly acceptable prayers. They are called wisdom psalms for a reason, right? They assure us of what our tradition believes and affirms about God, that God loves us, that God is with us, that God desires the best for us and for our world. And then they also then encourage us toward wise living. Sometimes we need to pray prayers of praise. Sometimes we need to pray prayers of lament. And then sometimes we need the wisdom of our faith community to guide us when we are troubled by what is happening in the world around us, or when we are troubled because of what we have discovered within us. One of the things I think the Psalms and the practice of prayer do for us is demonstrate that prayer is not about figuring God out. It's not about negotiating with God. It's not really even just about communicating what we need or what we want to God. The Psalms remind us that prayer is about becoming who God is forming us and transforming us to be in this world. Will you pray with me? Oh God, we are so grateful for the wisdom of those who have come before us. And we are thankful that we have honest and true words written in a prayer book that even though they're not our words, that they can become our words and our prayers. And we are just so grateful that you meet us wherever we are, and that you invite us into conversation, and you invite us into friendship with you. There is nothing greater than I can imagine than being a friend of God, a friend of Jesus Christ. Oh God, I pray that you will bless this community of faith, that you will grow them in your likeness, and that you will form them to be the people that they are called to be here in Urbana and beyond. Bless them, bless this community. We ask all this in your Son's name.